Hey folks, welcome back to the Armchair Dragoons podcast, and we've got a bit of a special presentation tonight, something a little off the beaten path. Before we get there, first things first, we have a name for the podcast. Yes, the podcast has been named thanks to all of your votes. Looks like 200-ish votes, maybe 150-ish votes. And mentioned in dispatches was our winner. So the podcast, at least for now, shall henceforth be known as Mentioned in Dispatches. It beat out Pants Are Overrated. It was actually a little close. Pants Are Overrated may turn out to be the motto of said podcast. The pod of the Light Brigade got some meager support, but not as meager as the other two options. So with that, we want to welcome our first guest to Mentioned in Dispatches, now that we have a name, and our guest tonight is Dr. James Sterrett. Good evening.
Hello.
It's a bit of an oddball kind of thing, but we're happy to have you here in your official capacity. And so the mandatory legalese, right? The opinions expressed during this podcast are yours and not official policy of the DOD and the Army and all that stuff, right?
And in fact, if you try to assert such, people will mock you.
Yes. Yes, mercilessly. And we're good at mocking people. So we excel at that. So for the listeners that may only know you as a somebody that runs those CPXs at Origins, what is the official job title that you carry out there at Fort Leavenworth, and what does it actually mean to real people?
So I work in the Directorate of Simulation Education, and somewhat circuitously, my position is the Chief of Simulation Education. What we do overall is we support exercises and education about simulation at CGSC and a number of affiliated educational institutions. CGSC is the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. There are a number of other teaching institutions associated with it. I'm not sure it's germane to this particular podcast to go into the detail of all of them. So the reason for calling our directorate Simulation Education instead of Educational Simulations or Simulation Education about Simulations is that we do both. So we both provide support for simulations, war games in the classroom, but we also provide education to students and or faculty about simulation and using simulations. I work with Mike Dunn. He's my co-teacher in many of these things, and some of you may have met him at Origins last year. There's a variety of courses that we teach, many of which are aimed first and foremost at FA-57s, who are the Army's simulation officers. They're the guys who are supposed to be the specialists on the staff at usually division higher, occasionally brigade, also in the simulation centers, in the mission command training program. There's also FA-57s at places like the National Training Center, the Joint Readiness Training Center, supposed to provide a chunk of the education they get. In theory, they come to us after they've gone to the simulation operations course, which is the foundation course for them. Then they go to CGSC, they get classes for us, and then they go out into the real world of the active Army. The actual picture is somewhat more muddy. Some of them get to us before they go to SOC, the simulation operations course. Some of them get to SOC and then have real jobs in the Army as FA-57s before they come to us, but it all works out in the end.
And usually that's just the vagaries of the assignment wheel, where somebody's needed to go fill a spot somewhere and the school timing just hasn't lined up correct before they're off on the next assignment, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I've seen that wheel spun enough times.
The 10,000-foot view of what I wind up doing is that there is a mix of putting on games for other people and teaching people about games in one way or another, and there's a mix of game design in there as well.
This would probably be a bad time to ask whether you're using games or simulations, wouldn't it?
We could get into that particular fight, but I'm right and you're wrong.
Not only that, but we only have an hour to work
for
with
those
here.
Not in the know, for those not in the know, Brant and I have been cheerfully sparring over these definitions for over a decade.
Yes, yes. But it's always been a great conversation starter when we have to tag team a seminar somewhere. We start with that as a conversation starter, and usually for a two-hour seminar, we can throw that out as a preamble in the first 2 to 3 minutes, and then you and I can pretty much sit down for the next 2 hours and let everybody else go with it, which can be refreshing sometimes to not have to drive a seminar to that level of effort. So with regards to the stuff that we're doing out at Fort Leavenworth, the students that we're talking about, you mentioned folks coming to Command and General Staff College. Look, I know from my military background, and you know because they're all your students, but for the audience that may not know, we're talking sort of earlier mid-career kinds of guys. So these are generally guys somewhere between 8 and 12 years in the Army, post-company command, so they've already been through their branch-level command work. Mostly majors, right? Occasional senior captain floating around here and there?
It used to be mostly majors. Now it is the intake of students is almost entirely captains promotable, meaning that they are captains, but they have already been told you're going to be promoted to major. You know, you've already passed the gate. The promotion board has said yes, and your date of promotion is going to be sometime in the next year, but you haven't actually been officially promoted.
Yeah, you're just waiting for your number to come up on the list so that somebody can pin you.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then, in a sense, the key thing to realize about these students, I guess, for me, is that if they've been here this long and they've shown up at CGSC, one, it means that they are considered to be among the top 50% of their year group.
Okay.
To come to resident CGSC.
Yep.
And second, anybody who has stayed in as an officer for the ish 10 years that it takes to get to CGSC is very likely committed to staying for another 10. These are career officers.
Yep. These are guys that are going to ride out the full 20 at least, if not beyond.
At least.
Yeah. And so briefly, the simulation operations course, I know that's generally outside your purview. But this is essentially the branch course that teaches them how to be an FA-57, which is the branch code for the simulations operations officers, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so where most of our listeners may be familiar with the concept of sort of an infantry officer basic course or the maneuver captain's career course or flight school if you're an aviator, or, you know, the intel course if you're an intelligence officer. Once these guys hit mid-career, they pick up a secondary specialty. In this case, they're sim officers. And
I'm going to break in. It's technically not a secondary specialty. They are entering a new specialty, and it becomes their branch. Just the same way that foreign area officers who are specialists in some country are then foreign area officers or people who become operations research specialists, ORSAs, have a different branch from then on, a functional area. The functional area 57 changes your branch. Your basic branch is still armor or medical or whatever it was originally, but you're now considered to be an FA-57 and you're in a different promotion pool than the armor or medical or whatever people
okay.
that you used to be with.
Okay. To get back to the support operations course is kind of almost the basic course all over again, if you will, for learning how to be one of these FA-57s. And then from there, they're off to the rest of their FA-57 career. Once they get to you, they've got some formal schooling that you guys are doing there. Is there another layer of formal schooling after you at some further point, another 5 or 6 years down the road?
In theory, because it hasn't always been offered, there's a intermediate simulation operations course and an advanced simulation operations course with intermediate aimed at senior majors or lieutenant colonels and the advanced simulation operations course aimed at colonels. And I am struggling not to call them ISOC and ASOC because we, of course, live in the land of acronyms.
Yeah. The what's the rough population in a given year group of FA-57s? Are we talking this is a small enough count that you can fit everybody in one class photo, or are we talking dozens of guys spread out across the Army from a particular year group?
Any given year group is between 15 and 20.
Okay.
As far as I know, we tend to see somewhere about between 8 to 16 a year.
Okay.
This particular year we've got 16, which is a nice bumper crop.
Okay. Sounds
they're thin enough on the ground that generally you wind up knowing most of them.
Yeah. So that's a lot of groundwork that we kind of wanted to lay for our listeners who may not understand how this is structured and organized through the Army. That's probably a little basic for some of our green suiters that might be listening and kind of rolling their eyes going, oh my gosh, this is such basic stuff. But for the people that are just, you know, hobbyists that might be interested in how the military interacts with this, we wanted to sort of get some of the groundwork down for the kinds of where these guys are in their career, what kinds of education in the Sims world. And let's face it, for the purpose of this discussion, we're going to use Sims and games pretty interchangeably. And where they're headed next beyond that, and sort of how many of these guys we're talking about in any given year. And it's not a big population. I mean, there's some specialty schooling as a part of it. It's not a big population. But these are mid-career guys that, you know, have already been through two or three assignments, have been through company command, have already been in charge of something somewhere. Many of them, I'm assuming at this point, you're still getting enough of them that have been deployed somewhere downrange.
It is unusual to see someone who does not have a right side patch.
Yeah. And in all of that, you mentioned that when these guys become FA-57s, that becomes their primary branch. The guys that are coming in, their background, is it primarily combat arms? Is it a mix? Is it unusual to find a combat arms guy in there? What's the basic branch background on these guys?
I've seen the numbers on this, and I don't recall them offhand, so I'm going to be vague. More than half are out of some kind of combat arms branch, followed by the logisticians, followed by lots of other backgrounds.
Okay.
And frankly, from my perspective, for FA-57, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The mix is not a bad one because in the end, they've got to be able to provide support to the staff, and they have to be able to speak the staff's language and understand what the staff is doing. So having a mix of backgrounds, it makes it more likely that you're going to have people with the background you need in any given location.
Yep, yep. Just a point of curiosity, because I don't know that this has ever come up in any of our discussions about this before. Everything we've talked about has been just a straight Army population. Do you get a straight Air Force or Navy guy coming through the program at some point?
So let's tease things apart here. By the program, do you mean the CGSC program and the courses we teach, or do you mean specifically the MMAS War Game Design Focus track?
I got a little ahead of us not getting down to the details of where the MMAS is, but that was more the program I was thinking, because I do know that there are other branches like the Air Force and Navy that will send folks through CGSC, where you'll end up with those guys as some of your students in the classroom, just as general CGSC students. I was thinking more of the specific MMAS program.
So specifically in the MMAS, well, I'm going to start a little further back. So I'm assuming you'll cut out.
How far back do you want to go here?
Well, I'm thinking to start this off. 1 in 16 students at CGSC is from the Air Force. 1 in 16 students at CGSC is from the Navy or the Marine Corps. So we've got a solid layer of joint flavor throughout the college. A number of them will choose to take our classes. How many varies from year to year? There's no predicting what it will be. And they're often great students. They're often some of our memorable students for the year, one way or another. Not least because often they are not as worried about admitting ignorance about things and poking holes in ideas as the Army students might be, simply because the Army students are surrounded by their peers and they're a little bit more restrained as a result. In the first year of the MMAS program itself, last year, we had only Army students in it, and it's not all FA-57s. And in this year, we have a Air Force officers.
Okay. So we've got some stray zoomies floating around.
We do. Neither of them a pilot, actually.
Wow. I suppose you knew that because they would have already told you by now if they were.
That, and often their uniform of the day is wearing their flight suits. So.
Yeah.
But also, the MMAS program itself, the part of it that we're in, the MMAS stands for Masters in Military Arts and Science. So it's a master's degree in military arts and science, which you have, as a student at CGSC, you have the option of doing in addition to all of your other coursework. Much of your other coursework counts as constructive credit towards it, but in addition, in the standard MMAS, you have to write a master's thesis. And there's are various courses that get you set up over the year, and you have a committee assembled out of the faculty, and you write your thesis and defend it near the end of the year. I've lost track of where I was going. I'm sorry.
The MMAS program.
This is one of those slides that this is one of those slides that I'm less healthy than I think I am. Yep. Again, things I'm hoping you will trim out to make this sound coherent.
Of course not.
So our corner of the MMAS program is the War Game Design Focus Track. We actually cap the number of people that we will take at 8 a year because Mike Dunn and I can't handle more than that. One of the requirements for it is that the committee chair has to be either Mike Dunn or me. Has to be somebody who is from our department, and that's a quality control issue. We want to make sure that somebody who knows game design is running it. What is different about our program is that they write a shorter thesis, a shorter standard thesis, and alongside that, as half of their project, they're going to design a war game on a topic of their choice.
Good.
So the students in the first year told us at the end that this was simultaneously the hardest way to get your MMAS because it was a lot more work, and the best because it was the most engaging and fun, and they felt that compared to their peers, they were more committed and more cheerfully engaged with their thesis down to the end than their peers were, because quite frankly, there's a lot of work to do simply as a student at CGSC, and when you ladle a master's thesis on top of that, then you're going to have a lot of late nights and you're going to have your family wondering why it is you aren't paying attention to them and so on. So it's a lot of work. So we start them off at the beginning of the year. We assemble the cohort for the year, if you will, and find out what they want their topics to be in general. We run them through a course on war games because many of them have little clue of what war games are. At least one of them came in cheerfully admitting that the most recent game she had played was Candyland and that had been 20, 30 years ago.
That was about to be my follow-up question, was how recently was that?
It had been a long time before. But and so this particular student was one of our great success stories, not least because she is a student who, because of her background, she was a medical officer, a medical administrator, and had almost no background in games whatsoever. And she wanted to do a game that would help people understand how a field hospital works.
Okay.
And we said, okay, sign up. But in the back of our heads, we were thinking, there's going to be some trouble here potentially because you've got so much background that is missing that we might expect. So we did what we do with all of the students, which is as soon as possible, typically this is kickstarting in the late August of the school year. So they've barely signed up and bang, we're off to the race. Put them through a crash course in these are the aspects of any war game. And for our purposes, those are divided into every war game will have models of time. It will have a model for space. It will have a model for assets, which is anything the player controls, and it will have a model or many models for resolution, which is when players take an action, how do you decide what happens next? What's the outcome? So we have four classes on that, four two-hour classes. A lot of that is me talking at them with a petting zoo of games laid out on three banquet tables in front of them. As we show them, you know, if you look at this game, you can see this being done in that, or this sequence of play here, or look at the difference between, you know, one of the specific things I like to do is haul out OCS Sicily, and sitting right next to it is Fast Time Battle Sicily. And not only are they maps of the same terrain, they are maps of the same terrain at the same scale, and they are totally different.
Yep.
One is hexes, one is areas, and it's a great compare and contrast to see what's the same, see what's different, and see how it changes the way that you have to approach the game as the player by changing that. So we try to do a lot of this to, even for the people who have no background, to load into their heads, hey, here are some approaches. So that we're hoping to be done with by about early to mid-September. I try to really get through that fast. For the next ish month and a half until mid-late October, what we're doing is directed play once a week. So Mike and I sit there and brainstorm between classes, given all of the students and their topics, and we brainstorm games that we think they need to play. And the next time they come in, we say, okay, you guys are sitting here, you guys are sitting there, you need to play this, you need to play that. We teach them enough to get it going, bounce around the room to try and keep all of the games going. And after about an hour and a half, we say, okay, now let's talk about this one. What did you notice about the models? What did you see in the models that's relevant to your project? What could you take from this that you're going to be able to use? And if they don't see the things that we had expected them to see, then we'll bring up the things we expected. Sometimes they will see things that we had not expected. There are absolutely moments of serendipity where, you know, I put Brandt into a game because I need to fill that game out, and it's going to be Brandt's week to get something aimed at him next week. But it turns out that the game this week sets a fire in Brandt's mind about, my gosh, I could manage to model, you know, whatever your topic is using this thing in this game. Mike and I had never considered it, and that's always a win. The deadline they've got in this initial stage is by the time we hit Thanksgiving, so realistically this means starting somewhere in the beginning of November, every student has to come in with a prototype of their game that is a serious attempt to make a playable prototype. I don't want somebody to come in and say, well, you know, I've got some pieces and a map and I'm sort of thinking about how to do it, but I'm not sure how it works. You got to really put your foot out there and say, okay, here we go. We're going to do it. Let's play this. And I tell them over and over again, as long as they hit that gate, I don't care if it crashes and burns. Because the impact point of the crash and burn, we can help them adjust from.
Yep.
So that it becomes better. So in many ways, the only defeat state there is they don't bring in something that we can try, that we can say, hey, it'll be better if, that their peers can be telling them in the program, can be telling them, hey, this would work better if. One of the real surprises for us in both teaching the MMAS students and in teaching the elective course on game design is the shocking importance of and value of giving feedback to your peers on their designs. We'd sort of known that it was probably going to be useful when we started doing the elective course before we started the MMAS option. And in the middle of the course, we were suddenly scrambling to rejig the course so we'd have more time for that to happen. And students routinely tell us that one of the things they learned the most from was sitting down with somebody else's game and playing it and giving them useful feedback on it, which fortunately we have yet to have any problems where somebody decides to be a twerp about the feedback process. It's constructive. It's to the point. It's sometimes pointed. It's not necessarily the thing you want to hear as the designer. You know, your game is bad, but nonetheless, it's good learning all around.
Yeah. Yeah. So after
they've hit that gate, then much of the rest of the year is they are simultaneously turning in pieces of the paper, and they are iteratively coming to testing sessions with their peers and testing the game, so that towards the end of the year they should be able to have a finished set of the rules and they've got their paper written up. That the central argument we're making all of them make is, here's my topic, here's what is important about my topic that has to be in the model, and here is why I've done a decent job of modeling those aspects of the topic in the game.
You mentioned...
So when we roll around... Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, you've mentioned the MMAS program, but then also the elective design course. I want to make sure that we make a mental note to circle back around to the distinctions between the two so that our audience gets that down the line. I don't want to derail your walk through the MMAS program, but I do want to make sure we come back around to the idea of the differences between the elective course and the overall program.
So, okay.
So with your MMAS stuff, we bring the students in to varying degrees of gaming experience.
Right. So there's another story that I was going to tell you. So we had the medical administration student,
okay,
who had almost no experience, and she really threw herself into it. She did a huge amount of work, and both on learning games, learning about games, learning about game design. She also did a huge amount of work on the medical side because the Army was in the process of changing the organization of its field hospitals, and she decided she was going to use the new organization, which meant researching that and going out into the field and getting from the field some reports on how the new organization was working and where its challenges were, and putting that back in the game. So her game wound up being something that impressed everybody who came across it. It was nominated, didn't make MMAS of the year, wasn't best of the year, but it was in the running to be that.
That's excellent.
So it was spectacular. And one of the things that it taught Mike and me, and in some ways this is a challenging lesson to have been taught, is that this second year of the MMAS program, we told people that there were 8 slots at there's a general briefing for the students on the MMAS special options, of which we are one of probably the better part of a dozen. And within 22 hours, I had 8 students signed up and a waiting list of 7.
You say it like it's a bad thing.
We were stunned by that. It's not a bad thing. It's a great problem to have. If we could figure out a way to maintain quality while increasing the number of slots that we could accept, then we would do it. We're thinking about how to do that, but we haven't hit on anything yet that we're entirely comfortable with. But one of the things that we talked about at one point was, well, what if there's some kind of application process? And how would you prove that you are worthy to get into this program? And in the back of our heads was that medical officer from the first year, because we're thinking, how do we build an application process that would accept her into the program, because she utterly, absolutely deserves to be in it,
yeah,
as shown by the results. And yet, most of the first pass things we would come up with might well have filtered that wonderfully deserving person out, and that would be a mistake. So how do we avoid filtering out the people who really need to be in the program, who are really fired up about it? And so far, the only thing that we've come up with is, how fast do they sign up, which has its real limitations as a filtering method, and I'm aware of that. But
it's the bad system that, you know, is better than any other bad system, huh?
Yeah, in a sense. If I could think of a better one that would manage to filter out so that we had only the best and they got the slots, then that would be perfect. But I'm faced with the reality that I can't know at the beginning who the best are going to be.
Yeah, yeah. Totally understand. So coming back around to the MMAS program, so we've got folks that are there at CGSC. They're there studying all their required military courses at the Command and General Staff College. And the MMAS program as a whole, not just your specific game design part of it, but any of the other options for the MMAS, that is layered on top of the Command and General Staff College course, correct?
That's correct.
So you're almost doing double work. And you know.
That's also correct.
You signed up for it, right? Nobody puts a gun to your head and makes you sign up for the MMAS program. Just out of curiosity,
for what it's worth, the dropout rate in the MMAS program as a whole is relatively high, particularly in the fall, as people realize exactly how much work they've gotten themselves into. And one of the things that we are surprised by, pleased by, is the attrition rate for our particular piece of the program is significantly lower.
Yeah. So
people seem to commit to it and they stick with it. We've had people drop out each year, and from my perspective, that's no hard feeling. So the student decides that they can't stick with it, they need to prioritize their family, whatever it is, then you know, more power to them for facing up to the realities of life and making a hard choice. Because frankly, that's the choice that will feel to them like failure. But I would rather they made the choice than dragged on to the end of the year without completing, and then we've got to figure out whether or not there's some way of getting them to complete after they graduate, or they eventually fail out of it, and there's the off chance, and we, after being involved with these since the mid-2000s, you take some care as the chair of one of these to make sure that as any student comes up to the elective sign-up period and comes around towards the end of the year, you're going to graduate whether or not you finish this or not, right? And make sure that they've got all those ducks lined up if there's the slightest doubt in your mind whether or not they're going to make it. Because in the end, the MMAS is the cherry on the top of their CGSC experience, their CGSC academic career, whereas graduating basic CGSC is absolutely necessary. They've got to do that.
So
we try to make sure that come what may, they will graduate, and ideally they come through the MMAS program.
Just for the curiosity of some of our folks, what are one or two of the other MMAS options beyond your game and sims design track there?
There is a historian option run, no surprise, by the history department. Sorry, I'm running out of water in my throat here. There's a strategic studies. There is a, I believe there's a civil defense. I know there's a space operations track. There's a, I'm going to stop at that point because I know there are more, but I'm not remembering exactly what they are.
Yeah, but that gives folks a good idea of, as you said, that gives the listeners a good idea of there's a variety of these things that people could work on an MMAS in beyond, the one we're interested in talking about, which is the games and sims.
There's also the general studies MMAS program in which you write a thesis, but it's not in one of the special tracks.
Okay. So you've got CGSC students who were there with you for a year. They've volunteered to do this MMAS on top of it, and part of that MMAS for their track, they're looking at sort of this games and sims design piece. We've talked a little bit about sort of what you do to them when they first get into the program, and some of the progress that they make towards their eventual game design, because they've got to spit out a game design at the other end. When you're talking about the actual MMAS game design curriculum, beyond, hey, here's a whole bunch of different kinds of war games, you should play a bunch of them to learn something, what are some of the other more formal types of coursework that you do with them versus some of the informal learning you expect them to pick up on their own?
I'm going to push back at your comment that they're picking things up on their own from playing the games. I do not view the directed play as being informal. That is no more informal than a film studies class, well, not a film studies class, a filmmaking class in which you sit down to watch a film by some great director, and then at the end of watching the film, or possibly even during it, if you hit the pause button, you stop and discuss his camera techniques. That's a very deliberate process of learning. And likewise, with the games that we're getting them to sit down with during the directed play, it's a very deliberate process. Mike and I know for each game, these are the mechanics. These are the features that we really want this person and this person to see. And you're at the same game, but we're wanting you to see these features and how they work together because we think it's specifically relevant to your project. In addition to that, now that I've pushed back at your characterization if that is informal. In addition to that, we have them read three different books during the first couple months. The first book is Raf Koster's A Theory of Fun for Game Design.
Excellent book. Love it.
The second book is Peter Perla, Art of Wargaming.
Also an excellent book.
And the third book is Phil Sabin, Simulating War. One of the funny stories about this, all of them love Koster, and Koster is the most sullen book I have ever bought.
And it only costs like $12 on Amazon. These people can't go buy their own?
Say again?
Koster only costs like $12 on Amazon. These guys can't go buy their own?
Well, I would loan it out to people, and then it would never come back, mysteriously. So, finally, I asked the library to buy these and put them on reserve for these students. None of the MMAS students have stolen a book from me. Other people have disappeared them. But everybody loves Koster. Koster is an easy read. It's very well put. And there's a lot of sort of delayed charge learning in it, in that in discussions we'll find people say, yeah, Koster was fun. It was easy. And then 3 months later, hey, you know, Koster said this. And suddenly it's making more sense to me as I get to this, and it's illuminating some part of my design. The other funny story about the reading is that at the end of the year last year, we were asking the students what they thought about it, what we could have done better, what they thought about the reading. And one of the students said, you know, Peter Perla is Clausewitz, and Phil Sabin is Chamonix. Because Peter Perla gives you all of the high-end theory and the overarching view, and then Sabin tells you exactly how to do it, all of the nuts and bolts. And I had the opportunity to tell Peter Perla this, and he thought it was great fun.
I'm going to put in a plug for Sabin's book, if only because I'm in the bibliography. That's a ridiculously petty reason to plug a book, right?
I'll recommend all three. They're all great.
Yeah. Koster is, for anybody interested in game design, I always tell folks, you got to read Raf Koster's book. It will get you thinking about game design as a formal process, which I'm not sure nearly enough people do. But it will do it in a way that entertains you and that doesn't feel like a burden to read. And I think where that really works well is it gets folks in the right mindset that, yes, there is a formal body of knowledge around game design, and they need to start thinking of it as a specific directed discipline with its own peculiarities. And what matters there is that game design should be taken seriously, and although that book is fairly light and fairly entertaining, it's a great gateway drug, right, to more detailed stuff.
It is. It's usually the first one people read.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Sabin and Perla as two of the wargaming luminaries, obviously. Have many of them picked up Zones of Control along the way somewhere?
I'm not sure many of them have. There are many books we could assign.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you're out of time at some point.
It's not that – right, exactly. I try to make sure that I don't assign anything that I'm not absolutely certain is going to be value-added, and that's simply respect for student time. And that's not knocking Zones of Control. I mean, there's a copy of it sitting on my shelf about 4 feet away, but
– it's a big-ass book.
significant chunks of zones of control are not directly relevant to what they need.
Yeah.
So, in the end, looking at the options, that was one of the things that fell by the wayside. Whereas for the MMAS guys, pretty much every chunk of Koster, Perlin, and Saba is relevant.
I was thinking less a requirement than if any of them had picked it up on their own out of curiosity for, hey, I wonder what we have in here. Or if any of them had come back looking for something else to read, looking for the next step to examine, had picked that one up. Just because it's...
Not that I remember offhand, which does not mean that they have not. Often the thing they're more in a pickle about is trying to figure out research sources for their chosen topic. Yeah. One of the challenges that has hit a couple of these students is they will be doing a topic that they know well, and most of which is highly classified. So yeah. Then they're in the problem of trying to find some way to demonstrate that the data that's being used to make the numbers in the game, because they're going to be numbers, is from an unclassified source. This can be, in some cases, a bigger challenge. One of the easier examples of working around is that we have a student this year who is an air defense guy, and he therefore knows all sorts of ins and outs about our missile systems and, you know, Russian missile systems and so on and so forth. However, most of it is classified. One of the absolute requirements for these is that they be unclassified public release, no classified material whatsoever.
Yep.
So what he has wound up doing is trawling through Janes and specifically using Janes and only Janes to get his data, because that way he's got a public source, and by using just the one and saying, hey, I'm going to take all the data from Janes, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, whether it's completely out to left field, doesn't matter, I'm using this source, and it's complete enough that it's got generally the data he needs. And where it doesn't, he could say, well, I'm going to use this broadly similar system that is in Janes to fill it in. And that way, he's covered. Because you can't sit there and say, well, obviously, he knew which of these 43 different sources had the right info, so he took it from there. And he's also got enough information. One of the other big challenges, we have a student this year who's doing a game on cyber operations. And declassifying that has also been a challenge. I don't know any of the classified side of any of these. I don't want to. I don't need to. But they have to find source material they can point at, because this is a research project that gives them the background for the systems in the game.
Yeah, I can see that being a bit of a challenge when you're dealing with things on the professional side. Something that is going to be of interest to our listeners, it's probably not necessarily a high priority in the grand scheme of the course that you're teaching overall, but I'm sure our folks are going to be curious what a smattering of the games that you've chosen for people to sit down and play might have been, and what was an example of a particular lesson that you were wanting to demonstrate out of one of them. You mentioned the comparison earlier about OCS Sicily with Fab Sicily. What are some of the other things you threw on the table and had people sit down at, and what were some of the particular lessons from a game design or military applicability direction that you were trying to get them to pull out of those games?
So just thinking about the past fall, we've had games that ranged from Downtown, which the Air Defender and I sat down and actually had a great time with. I finally got to play the game. To the Trial of Louis Riel, which is a game on the Trial of Louis Riel from Victory Point that most people have not heard of. And that's sort of two ends of the spectrum of things that we might sit down with somebody. Downtown, if you're running it, Downtown is a game on U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy strike packages going over North Vietnam and the North Vietnamese air defense system, and they're both missiles and flak and aircraft are trying to shoot them down. So the applicability of that to the Air Defender's game design was pretty immediate. So we're running through it and say, okay, what can you take? Is this too complex? What can't you take? And as a tribute to Lee Brimcombe Wood there, his comment on the game was, everything in this is correct. Like, the systems are the way they ought to be. He wasn't sure whether it was too complicated, but so it goes. On the sort of the other end of the spectrum, Trial of Louis Riel, ostensibly, if you look at the theming of it, is completely out to lunch. Because what does a trial have to do with military operations unless you're doing a game about some kind of legal trial? But there's a lot of hidden intelligence and intelligence work that is cooked into that trial game. You start off with 12 jurors sitting out there as cards, and put on top of them, upside down, hidden, randomly, each one gets a language, and each one gets a profession, and each one gets a religion. So they either are English-speaking or French-speaking. This is a Canadian trial from the late 1800s. And they're either government workers or bankers or farmers, or merchants or farmers. And they are either Catholic or Protestant. And one of the significant things you're trying to do in the game is to sway either the English and or the French and or the Catholics and or the Protestants, so on and so forth, to be favored to your side of the trial, either favoring the defense or favoring the prosecution. At the beginning of the game, the first section is voir dire. It tracks the trial very precisely. And you are playing cards in order to get the opportunity to either reveal or peek at the characteristics of various jurors. So if you reveal them, they're just flipped over. Both sides see this. Hey, now we know that this guy is a Catholic. The more interesting thing there is peek, at which point you just turn the counter towards yourself. There's an arrow on the hidden side of it. And the arrow towards you means you're allowed to look at it and your opponent is not. So now there's something I know and you do not, which is a pretty interesting intelligence model. It's also, and this is a more abstract thing to look at in the game, all of the cards have at least three, if not four, different ways that they can be used at different times in the trial. And some of the cards that you're getting in every round of the game, you know, you're going through jury selection, then you're going through two sets of arguments, and then you have closing arguments. The closing arguments cards are ones you saved from earlier in the trial. You've set them aside explicitly. So it's also a good way for them to look at, oh, here's a way that we can have a resource that people can use in multiple ways, the card, and handle that multi-use as something that plays against itself. The influence tracks themselves also are a way that people can look at modeling international relations, for example. Or they could model trying to do interpersonal relationships on a staff. So there's often it's the mechanic itself that we're trying to get them to engage with and then take out and then put somewhere other than the immediate trappings of the game.
So you're trying to de-theme
it. And I can rattle on and on. Say again?
So you're trying to de-theme it.
We're trying to. Yeah, well, from my perspective, everybody comes to any game with sort of two brains. You've got a play brain and you've got a game brain. And the play brain sees the theme and says, oh, this game is about hunting submarines in the North Atlantic. And therefore, I'm going to, you know, chase them with destroyers and figure out where the convoys go and so on and so forth. The game brain sees nothing except the mechanics. It wants to win, it wants to crunch the numbers, and it wants to destroy the enemy. So whatever that constitutes in the game, it will do it. If there is a method of winning the game that is completely stupid in terms of the theme, but it works in the mechanics, the play brain wants to do it. Let's go. Let's win. So when the play brain discovers that this game about hunting submarines in the North Atlantic has the mechanics of go fish, it says, all right, we know how to play go fish. Let's go.
Yeah.
And then the play brain is saying, wait, what? So you want, ideally, for the mechanics of the theme to line up. For when there's a rule, people look at it and say, oh, given what I know about the theming, of course this rule is here. It makes perfect sense that the rule would be here. But equally, you can often take mechanics, rip the theme off of them, and look at that skeleton and say, hey, I could put, you know, this bone from the skeleton in some other – this example is going to fall apart at some point – into some other animal and stitch together my own new strange game.
Once you start pulling bones out of skeletons, it tends to fall apart. So
it does. But fortunately, the process tends to work, that you can take mechanics from game A with topic, whatever it is, a trial, and then apply them to things that are ostensibly completely different and still make use of them.
We've, in this discussion, it's been virtually all tabletop. As I recall from our earlier discussions, you're not putting any of these guys on a computer for the game design part. They might use them to help create components or something, but we're not creating digital games, correct?
They're not. Nobody has the time, unless they are a spectacularly good programmer, to both design the game and create it on a computer in the time that we've got. I've left the door open for that a crack, in that if a student comes along and they are already a exceptionally competent programmer, a great programmer, then I would be willing to consider entertaining the idea. But I've seen the amount of work these people have to do for both my program and for the regular CGSC studies, and I'm deeply unconvinced that unless code flows from your fingers like water, that you'd be able to manage to make it happen.
Yeah.
I think it's simply much more realistic to say, hey, do it in paper for us and then go forth and make the electronic version later.
Well, and you and I both also know a variety of computer game devs, and we know how long it takes for them to crank out anything. Literally years in some cases, with that being a second, almost full-time job. And the fact that you've got 1 year to work with for these guys, I totally see how it's not realistic to expect that.
And frankly, the state they get the designs to by the end of the year it's an advanced prototype. It's certainly not publisher ready. It's not something you could say, hey, GMD, let's kick this out tomorrow. It might be, is generally at the stage where you could start taking it to a publisher and say, hey, would you be interested in this if I developed it more? And they might say yes. So it's advanced in that sense. It has been tested and refined, but they don't have enough time to get further. And that's one of the things that there was discovery learning for us on, is that our initial concept was, hey, we're going to get this publisher ready. And the reality was there's not enough time. Even given wonderful amounts of effort, there's just not enough time to get the game that far. And if you were trying to do an electronic game, which you had to fix all the bugs in as well as refine the design, I think it would be even more impossible.
So, we talked before we started recording about a couple of things we wanted to talk about, and we haven't even gotten to one of the key topics yet, and we're rapidly approaching an hour. But that's fine. I think folks are going to be learning a lot about sort of what you've got here with the DoD, or the Army specifically. A couple of things I do want to ask about in terms of some particulars. You mentioned we've got this elective class out there that existed already that was sort of the genesis of building out into this overall program. Where did the elective class come from, and how did we get from the elective class to the full MMAS, if we can do that in under 20 minutes?
The elective class grew out of discussions with the Army Model Simulations Office that runs the simulation operations course to make sure that what we were doing nested well with what they were doing. So we had, for many years, we had run a fairly technical elective on simulation management, which got pretty well under the hood with the specific simulation varied, but it was at various points JCATS, and at other points it was OneSAF, and making sure that students had really seen the elephant in terms of making sure the data flowed from it into a battle command system. And we had a section on how a computer actually worked, which was kind of a neat class. We would start it off with a banquet table, standard folded banquet table, covered in computer parts. And we would talk through what each of the parts did. And as we were talking through this, starting with the motherboard and going to the CPU and then the memory and so on and so forth, we would also say, okay, so, hey, you, why don't you install this on the motherboard? Here's how you do it. And by the end of the class, we've got all the pieces put into the motherboard and the power supply hooked up, and it's plugged into a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse, and we press the power button and make it run. But the simulation operations course was, and they were right to be doing this, was taking on a lot of that. So we figured that we had an opportunity in there, and they agreed to go into game design. So we started that. And at the point that we'd run the first iteration of that elective, electives run for, it's 24 contact hours in a class, so 24 hours talking to students over typically 12 sessions, 12 two-hour sessions at the end of the year. We'd run through this, and one of the guys who runs the graduate degree program was down talking with us and said, hey, you know, we're looking to expand the number of special tracks. What could you guys do? And we said, well, what about a war game design track? And he said, excellent. When can you start? And we said, now. What do we do? And that meant that we had some prep that we were able to do over the summer, but we discovered pretty rapidly the first year that there were many things that we had not known we needed to do. So we did our best to to lay the tracks as the engine was charging down the rail line. And it seemed to run okay, so we've tried to fix the things that we were able to figure out how to fix, and we've driven on. One of the challenges in both of them has been the petting zoo. Not in that it is difficult for me. I can set out the petting zoo and rabbit on about it for an extended period of time.
I'm thinking days bleeding into weeks.
yeah, potentially. But I've got 2 hours. And particularly in the elective version, when I've got far less time with the students, there's a real need to have there be some discussion in and around the petting zoo. So we are, on the one hand, we are wanting to take that and try and make essentially the YouTube lecture version of the petting zoo for each of those four classes, and then have students watch that and come in. But equally, we get feedback every time from students that they like the fact that it's in person, because people in the class can spark up with questions as it goes and say, hey, what about? And that will often knock me onto a completely different track about what I'm talking about, and we go into their question and explain it, and they learn more. And that interaction is important. There's a lot of learning from that. So we're not sure how to do that. Another, how to solve that particular problem. Another dilemma that I run into and find frustrating is that I would like to play every single student's game every single time they come in for testing. And unfortunately, there's only one of me, and typically there's three or four students doing testing. So I can't. And over the course of the MMAS, because I got a year and there's lots of testing sessions, I can make sure that eventually I've sat down with each student and played their game for a couple hours and talked it through with them and given them some feedback. With the elective, I can't physically manage that. There's not enough time. And instead, what happens is that I drift around the room spending 10, 15, 20 minutes with one, then 10, 15, 20 minutes with the next, which often means that I am listening in and listening to the discussion as they get it underway or as it falls apart, and putting my oar in where I can do it usefully. But I am all too aware of the fact that that's not as good as it can be. And in the end, there is no good solution to that. It's a time problem and an inability to clone myself problem. So my only solution to it is to do the floating.
Yeah.
This is why I do it, and it's not the ideal situation. We have found that it is helpful where we can to, generally not for the first showing of their games, but for later ones, to start getting other wargamers to come in and help out with the testing. So we'll try and advertise to a slightly larger group in the community of people who come in and say, hey, you know, we're testing on this day. Feel free to drop in and try out some of the games and give them feedback, which keeps fresh eyes on the product and often gives them new and better ideas about how to approach problems.
Once somebody completes the course, what's the next step for them, both in terms of their career and sort of what happens to all these game designs?
There's So what happens to them next in their career is the typically around halfway to two-thirds of the way through the year, they will learn where the Army is sending them next, and they go off to do that. Some of them have left saying, yes, I'm going to be using this at my next job, and that's cool. And sometimes we hear back and hear that it worked, which is extra cool. I know that one guy wanted to publish his, started Kickstarter, and then it ended, and I'm not actually sure why it ended, why it was canceled, because it had gotten enough pledges to fund. The other thing that happens to them is that there's a single person in the graduate degree program's office, and she is massively overworked, who prepares all of these theses after they've been submitted to be put into the Combined Arms Research Library on post, which is the big academic library attached to CGSC. So all of them wind up there in, among other things, there's the standard bound thesis copy. There is, for the games in this program, there is a playable copy in a box, and one of the archivists will figure out what the box is supposed to be and how to set it up. So you could walk into that library and sign it out within the library and play it there. And last but not least, all of them also wind up being in PDF and are downloadable. So once they've been posted up, they have not been, unfortunately, yet, then anybody in the world could go to the Carl Library website and find them and download them.
Yeah, we intend to help with folks finding them and downloading them once you finally tell us that they're up there. Over at Armchair Dragoons, we certainly want to help these guys get the word out and make sure that we're linked to those public record copies that folks are allowed to see. Quickly, you mentioned your medical student as one of your bigger success stories in terms of putting the work in and getting somewhere. What's another one of your big success stories for somebody that turned out an excellent game or just made some excellent progress through the course of the conduct of the course coming out the other end as a particularly good success story of a student plowing through there?
I'm pausing while I cast my mind back to last year, which was a long time ago, you know. Inevitably, if I pick too many favorites, then somebody gets slighted, which is not intentional.
It's an occupational hazard of being a teacher.
It is. The blanket statement in many ways is that we were pretty thrilled by all the projects that completed. We had a game on – I already talked about the field hospital game, and the field hospital game was prepare the field hospital and then deploy it and then operate it and then move it while you're operating it and keep operating it while not having many people die. And unfortunately, people were going to die. And people always found it deeply frustrating, but they always said they learned. My moment of learning with that one is I decided that – since you don't have enough organic lift assets, trucks in the organization to lift everything at once, you don't have anywhere near enough to carry the whole hospital at once. When we deployed, I decided that the initial deployment, I didn't need the laundry and bath unit. That does not mean you just have stinky doctors because they haven't had showers. It means you don't have clean linen for the patients in your bed. And that is medically disastrous. So I had people dying as a result. That was a harsh lesson, but it's a good lesson. And it's one of the things it was intended to teach. Hey, why do you need the laundry and bath unit? Oh, crap, that's what it does. All right, it's big, but maybe we got to figure out a way to lift it in. Was it more important than having that second surgery theater? Now you're making really nasty decisions. We had a guy who did his game on commanding a brigade at the National Training Center through a rotation. We had a game on the Battle of Leipzig in 1814. We had a game on the Eastern Congo, modern game in the Eastern Congo. I think you just interviewed that guy. That was Justin Williamson from the State Department. And if nothing else from that, I learned just how much of a mess the Eastern Congo is. And the game understates it because you can't have enough players to have enough factions. We had a game on the 1862 campaign in the West of the American Civil War, which focused on logistics, which was certainly a nifty way to look at it. We had a game on running a National Guard infantry company in the state of California. The guy was a California National Guard officer, and you're trying to train it. So at the beginning of the year, you build your training program using the 39 days that you get of training time. And then, of course, there's a fire,
yep.
Forest fire, and you get called up for it. Or there's an earthquake, or, and all these contingencies come up, and your training plan gets blown away. But in theory, you could be deployed at the end of the year. Are you trained?
Yeah.
So it's a very real-world problem. And in some ways, this was a linear programming exercise that then you had chaos thrown at it. But it was a good training product on how you deal with those problems. I am scandalously, I think, forgetting one game. And somebody is going to write me a nasty note if they hear this. But there were – all of these projects we were happy about.
I can tell you, having really been a serving California National Guardsman who was sworn in on Monday and then mobilized on Friday for 6 weeks of flood relief duty, that is a very, very real-world circumstance. Been there, done that, got a couple of T-shirts for it. So it's if it is unlikely that the military is going to formally institutionalize any of these designs, however, correct?
Correct. Not least because to formally institutionalize any of these designs, somebody would have to be in a place to more or less push it through. And I suspect few of them are ever going to be in that place. But if I can anticipate the next question, which is, well, so what? The wider hope that I've got is that, one, that these students can move out and in their next job or the job after next or something like that, that they can use the design, that it turns out to be useful for them in what they're doing. The second and broader hope is that by educating these guys and gals, you know, it's both, on both wargaming and wargame design, we are empowering them to be able to design another game at their next job. Or to say, hey, you know, there's this commercial game that would fit, and they pluck it off the shelf, and ta-da, they use it in that job. One of the surprising things for me was that I gave a class for a visiting group of high school teachers a couple weeks ago, and as part of this visit, there were also some other senior officers running around talking to them. And in talking to them about teaching with games, as a case example, I had them play Hanabi, which, if you're not familiar with it, is a cooperative puzzle game in which you are trying to get tiles laid out. I have the tile version. Tiles laid out in order, by number, by color. And the catch is you're not allowed to look at your own tiles. So it's very much a game of within the constraints of the game, which are very tight, communicating very effectively and very precisely what it is that other people need to know about their tiles. And the example I'm using it for is that it gets at all of the various aspects of critical thinking. All of them are exercised by this cooperative puzzle game. And to my surprise, one of these senior officers was helping out coaching the groups. So I asked, oh, you've played this before. Oh, yes, I use it with my staff. It's like, cool. So I asked the senior officer to stand up at the end of that play and explain how it was that it was used with their staff, and that was nifty. So in a sense, it's that kind of thing, although I had no responsibility for this happening at all in that person's staff, it's that kind of thing I'm trying to encourage, that we'll get better training, better education across the force as a whole by seeding out these people who are better clued into the opportunity.
That's excellent. We are way over our 1 hour mark. And let's face it, you and I could continue for at least another 2 hours on this discussion. If the combination of, borderline sick voices, the internet and our wives' patience all held up, that we could go for, that we could continue to go for quite some time. But we appreciate you putting on the official hat long enough to sort of give people an inside look into kind of how the games work in the military space. Because look, it's funny. Look, a lot of us that have both military experience and are hobby wargamers have inevitably had those Venn diagrams overlap. And at some point, we pulled out the games while we were in uniform to try and use them as teaching tools. You just can't help it. It's another one of the tools you use for training. The what we see when we have our hobby hats on and somebody starts to bring up the professional training is inevitably the hobbyists want to jump in and start telling us why we're doing everything all wrong. There's at least one in every crowd. Anybody that hangs out at Board Game Geek knows exactly who I'm talking about. But there's always at least one in every crowd, and usually a couple. And they're usually not just wrong, they're demonstrably wrong, and despite having been told how wrong they are multiple times, still insist how right they are. And so I think something like this is very useful for illuminating a variety of ways in which these tools can be used, and a variety of considerations beyond just, hey, I can beat you at a board game, as being a relevant, useful tool. I really like the idea of the cooperative game in the staff world. I think that's an outstanding idea. Even if it's just a team building exercise, I think that's a great idea for helping the staff get together.
Reiterating the pitch then, Hanabi is a spectacular game as a cooperative team building, staff building, critical thinking, clear communication exercise. It's pretty easy to teach. Most people get on with it well. We've had one person who is otherwise a very good gamer who could not remember from moment to moment what he had been told, what clues he'd been given about his pieces. But most people get on with it pretty well.
Yeah.
So my only recommendation is get the deluxe version that has the tiles instead of the standard version that has the cards for two reasons. The first of which is, the tiles wear better than the card, so it'll last longer. You may find it comes out frequently. And the second of which is, everybody has a really well-trained reflex that you pick up a card and you look at it, which in Hanabi means you cheated and you have to put it back in the deck. And with the tiles, that reflex is less ingrained. So it's easier for people to remember that, you know, they pull the tile over and then flip it up so that everybody else can see it and not them.
Yeah, yeah. The look, again, let's throw the legal disclaimer in. These are all your opinions. This isn't official DOD policy. The Army's not making you say this stuff. To my knowledge, we haven't had the public affairs guys eavesdropping on all of this, although I'm sure they can't wait to come back and listen to it once it gets released.
Although I had permission from the PAO to conduct the interview. So.
Yes, yes. Thank you, PAO, for the permission there. We do appreciate it. Having been a PAO briefly, I can appreciate the tough spot that those guys are in sometimes. So we appreciate you joining us. And folks, watch the Armchair Dragoons website as the games start getting released on the Carl, the digital library, the Carl library. We're gonna get linked back to them so that folks can find them and see. If you haven't already hit our website and seen it, by the time this episode of Mentioned in Dispatches is live, we will have had an interview with two of Dr. Sterrett's students from last year live on our website. So if you haven't gone back and found that article, you're certainly welcome to. Appreciate you swinging in here and joining us. And I think this is all going to be some really interesting content. I don't know what mechanisms folks may have to pester us with some questions. But I'm certain if people start popping up on the Armchair Dragoons forums, I'll make something up that might sound convincing, and then sooner or later we can get some kind of clarification and answers back. Is there a website somewhere out there where they can go look up some public information on this program that you guys have that the rest of the world can see? Or is there nothing yet publicly releasable?
I don't think there's much out in the public about this.
All right, so the only place you can find out about this is coming and listening to our podcast. So that's really cool. people have to come to us for the information. So I'm gonna protect my rice bowl here and not let anybody else find out about it without coming to talk to us. So that's awesome. But this is great. Thank you for joining us. And folks, mentioned in dispatches is a little more than halfway through our first season at armchairdragoons.com. So please definitely keep coming back, checking it out. We're going to wrap up our first season shortly before the holidays, take a break for the holidays, and then come back afterwards and start season two sometime in the new year. Dr. Sterrett, thank you for joining us. And
Thank you for having me.
Make sure you thank the PAO and everybody else involved in the approval chain for allowing you to do this. And tell them to send all the hate mail to me, because I'm okay with it. It's totally fine. Good night, everybody. For the newly christened Mentioned in Dispatches podcast here at armchairdragoons.com, we appreciate you joining us, and we'll talk to you on our next podcast.